News. What's so funny about this love and understanding? Oh. And for WBAI Chicken.
Hi, this is Tony Roberts, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
This is Cat Radio Cafe, a salon of the arts exploring the creative bounty of New York. From WBAI Radio 99.5 on the FM dial, I'm Janet Coleman, and you are...
David Dozer.
The displaced playwright. On tonight's show, we'll be joined by composer Ricky Ian Gordon and librettist lyricist Michael Curry to discuss the upcoming world premiere of their opera, The Garden of the Finzi Continis, based upon Giorgio Bassini's 1962 novel about an old and aristocratic Italian-Jewish family on the eve of World War II who believe themselves immune to the encroaching Jewish racial laws and the coming alliance between Mussolini's fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. But first, an urgent WBAI fundraising request. Tonight, we invite you to call 212-209-2950 to make a contribution to our Emergency Tower Fund Drive. Your contribution will cover rental payments on our transmitter space at 4 Times Square.
You know, without a transmitter, there's no radio signal.
That's right. There's no WBAI.
Yeah.
Well, we can't let that happen. That is not possible.
No, we can't. So, you know, please help. Call 212-209-2950, or you can go online to towerfund.wbai.org.
Make a contribution in any amount.
That's
big or small.
Oh, it could be big.
Big is good.
Big as you can stand.
Very good.
That's towerfund.wbai.org.
And make sure this precious, uncensored free speech signal remains vibrant and alive, like we say, Viva WBAI.
Well, and as the great Swedish playwright August Strindberg would say,
Ooh, translation, please.
Pass the salt.
I thought so. And now? On tonight's show, we'll be joined by composer Ricky Ian Gordon and librettist lyricist Michael Curry to discuss the upcoming world premiere of their opera, The Garden of the Finzi Continis, based upon Giorgio Bassini's 1962 novel about an old and aristocratic Italian-Jewish family on the eve of World War II who believe themselves immune to the encroaching Jewish racial laws and the coming alliance between Mussolini's fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. The story resonates mightily with its themes of discrimination, exclusion, and fascism that is appropriate for the world stage today. The Garden of the Finzi Continis is a co-production of the New York City Opera and the Yiddish Theater Volksbühne, and it opens on January 27th, plays for 8 performances only, at Edmund J. Safra Hall in the Museum of Jewish Heritage, a living memorial to the Holocaust. Composer Ricky Ian Gordon, his other upcoming work this season is Intimate Apparel, with a little libretto by Lynn Nottage, based upon her acclaimed play, premiering later this month at Lincoln Center. His other works include the operas The Grapes of Wrath, which he wrote with Michael Curry himself, Ellen West, The House Without a Christmas Tree, 27, that's the address of Gertrude Stein, The Tibetan Book of the Dead, and Orpheus and Eurydice, to name a few. For theater, he has composed music for the musicals Sycamore Trees, My Life with Albertine, and Dream True. His honors include, and I'm sure I'll be short on this, I will have eliminated too many of these awards, but will include an Obie, the Helen Hayes Award, the AT&T Award, the Richard Rogers Award, and the Stephen Sondheim Award. Another upcoming project is the musical Private Confessions with playwright Richard Nelson. Librettist lyricist Michael Corey's librettos include The Grapes of Wrath, Harvey Milk, Hopper's Wife, Kabbalah, and the upcoming Supermax. He wrote the lyrics for the musical Grey Gardens, which was the winner of the Outer Circle Award, and also was nominated for Tony, Drama Desk, and Grammy. And he also, the author, the lyricist of the recent musical at Lincoln Center, Flying Over Sunset, with music by James Lapine. He is the winner of a Mark Blitzstein Award, the Edward Kleban Prize, the Jonathan Larson Award, and the ASCAP Richard Rogers Award. He teaches lyric writing at Yale University and libretto writing at Columbia University School of the Arts. Well, my two illustrious guests, welcome to Cat Radio Cafe. I'm kind of blown over by your expertise in these fields, and I was also, of course, blown away reading the libretto of this play and listening to the music in rehearsal of it, this opera. It is extraordinary and so moving and so weirdly appropriate that I must ask you at what point in the zeitgeist did you realize this must be created, an opera about the Finzi-Continis, this family who exist in a novel and in a film by Vittorio De Sica, and now this extraordinary piece of music and lyric writing. Talk.
Michael, should I start, Michael?
Yeah, yes. Why don't you take it, Ricky?
You take it away, Ricky.
It starts a little bit with me because Michael and I had completed The Grapes of Wrath at Minnesota Opera, and we were looking for our next project. And one night, I was walking home on 72nd Street, and I decided to rent the movie, Garden of the Finzi-Continis, which I had seen about every 5 years since I was 15.
Huh.
And I had a very strange reaction to the movie that night. I was sort of inconsolable and hysterical when it was over. And I thought it was a sign. And I called Michael and said, I think this should be our next project. And just to say that, of course, when we were working on it, and Michael, by the way, didn't flinch, but you can't not feel its contemporaneity when you're working on it. I mean, just two or three mornings ago, NPR did a piece on the rise of anti-Semitism. And there will always be unfortunately, what's going on in the world at the moment of the Finzi-Contini family is happening now. And I mean, I don't think anyone would argue with what looks like an encroaching rise of autocracy in this country. And what moved me about the story, and then I'll hand it over to Michael, is the fact that it's really about heartbreak and about unrequited love. But what makes that particularly poignant is the backdrop is catastrophe.
Sure. Yeah.
Go, Michael.
Go. Perfect setup for an opera, however.
You know, yes. Ricky suggested the idea. I was in a mood to do Valley of the Dolls, the opera.
Right.
But that turned out to be not available. And then Ricky suggested this, and I instantly thought, oh, yes. Because I'm a political person. Ricky's a political person. Mm-hmm. I used to be a journalist, and I'm very much of the feeling that whatever you write for the theater or the opera has to speak to the audience that is coming to it. And but it's tedious and tiresome to lecture to an audience. And it's also somewhat tiresome to preach to the converted. So I always look for a subject that can kind of, I call it a stealth opera, like a stealth fighter. It can have a message, but you don't realize instantly. Like in The Grapes of Wrath, it was very clearly about the time that we wrote it, but it was set in a different time, and people caught on as it went on. Mm-hmm. And I think this time they'll say, oh, I'm coming to see an opera that takes place in the 30s and pre-World War II in Italy. It's a historical work. And then they're going to realize, I hope, about 5-10 minutes in, that it's about right here and now. It's so sad that it's happening here and now, that what happened in Nazi Germany, what happened in Italy to the Jews who were assimilated, who were part of the society, and suddenly their neighbors who they had always had friendly relations with begin turning on them and begin believing in propaganda and that casting blame on them, that they are the cause of all their problems. it's happening here.
Sure.
It's horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that an opera can respond to political trends or political circumstances, I think it makes it stronger.
You know, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
That's it.
Well,
yeah.
No, I was just going to say that I'm really reminded of it today. You have the idea that basically that the Jews of Ferrara are slowly having everything taken away from them because mm-hmm. of the Mussolini's Manifesto della Razza, the racial laws.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just thinking about every day you look at the paper, and right now Biden is trying to figure out how to deal with voting rights. But every day he has someone like Christian Sinema or Joe Manchin. You basically mm-hmm. have the party you're in cannibalizing itself,
mm-hmm.
making it impossible to get mm-hmm. anything done. And it's immoral. And when someone like Joe Manchin is built up, when meanwhile his interests in coal are so immoral and so confounded. And it's such a difficult time to be an American and to mm-hmm. read the news. And I really feel like this piece, unfortunately, speaks to that. It's no different than it was then.
Well,
not
also
really.
We grew up post-Holocaust mm-hmm. with, you know, never forget, always remember. But this country has a problem remembering yesterday.
Yes.
Or even 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
And but I never, ever expected in my lifetime that I would begin to see the rights that we all worked so hard for, women's rights, civil rights, gay rights, gay marriage, everything being chipped away bit by bit, and with the expectation that it could all go away with this alliance between the religious right and the Republican Party and fascism. And it's a reminder. It can happen again. It can happen here.
Yes.
Well, this is really an example of actually watching the frog in the boiling water. You
yes.
see how one by right by right, these people are stripped of their humanity, and in the case of the Finzi Continis, their servants, their ability to bank, their ability, you know, and you feel sorry for them, but you do want to say, wake up. And then you think, well, wait a minute. I'm sitting here. I'm not
That's
doing
right.
anything.
Right.
I'm boiling in water.
Yeah. Are we waking up? I mean,
yeah.
that's the thing. And I sometimes I feel like we won't wake up because we're all so self-entertained with whatever we're holding in our hands.
Mm-hmm.
We'll never mobilize and go out into the street and say no. It'll happen to us as quietly as it happened to them. And, you know, this is really like, it sounds like, you know, we're like doomsday. But meanwhile, we wrote a very beautiful opera about
doomsday.
The encroachment of doomsday.
Yeah, well, right. It's a lesson, several lessons, but I don't
yes.
know. It's a lesson in how to recognize what's going wrong. It's not necessarily a blueprint for how to get out of it, except you got to recognize it. You can't let it go.
I think it is. I think it is about being able to see what's in front of you and choosing not to. In the case of the Finzi Contini family, they've been there for centuries, a landed, respected family that practically considers itself Christian.
Mm-hmm.
They did form their own temple as a, you know, a bountiful gesture towards the community there, but they are not religious attenders. They're and they don't think that the world can touch them. They have this beautiful estate. They live behind the wall. They have a tennis court. They can be remote and noble, but they don't realize that the wall is invisible. The wall doesn't exist. The wall that they think that they have built is going to vanish, and they are going to be in the same situation as everyone.
Right.
And it also has to go, it also applies to the more middle class Jews of Ferrara, who once believed in the populist notions of Mussolini and went along with it long after they saw that they should have changed.
Mm-hmm.
It also applies on a romantic level to our hero, Giorgio, who is based somewhat on the author of the book, and his love affair with the the daughter of the Finzi-Contini family, mm-hmm. who basically is not sexually aroused by Jewish men, and does not want to make love to someone who she considers like a brother.
Right.
And he doesn't see that either. He does
and
not
a lower,
see.
And a lower class brother.
And a lower yes. class. And yeah. he doesn't right. see that there's that she would like to be friends and no more. She mm-hmm. will never love him. And she also has a fatalistic view of life, that she can never basically leave her garden. She knows she's doomed to die out with her family. Giorgio sees none of that because his heart is filled with love, and he stays too long.
Right. And his expectations are that of a middle-class guy. You go upward. You don't go. You don't escape your country. You make your way in it. We'll talk a little bit about the how you set this up. I believe the book and the film are, both have prologues and epilogues, so that the figure of Giorgio he's part of the story, but he's also observing the story. We see him return to the town of Ferrara post-war, and we see his horror at seeing the temple destroyed, the light blown out, the eternal light not lit, under the aegis of the janitor that was given money by the Finzi-Continis to keep the light alive, and it's a shock to everybody, and then to him and to us in the audience, and I'm thinking we should probably hear a bit of the scene where the Jews in the synagogue express their opinions about the Finzi-Continis. What characterizes a non-Jewish Jew or an aristocratic Jew so rich and so pampered that their prayers are just kind of a lucky strike extra? They don't have to do it, but they do. Like giving a wing to a hospital, something like that.
Right.
You know, they're secure behind their gates and their gardens. So shall we hear a little bit about this? You want to set up how the Finzi-Continis are different. The name of the piece.
Set yeah. that up, Ricky?
No, you set that up, Michael.
Okay, well, this takes place...
No, you.
Because he wrote the words.
Yeah, right.
After the prologue, which bookends the piece, you mentioned that it's set in this devastated synagogue after World War II. Giorgio has returned as a grown man and needs answers to what happened in his youth. And he remembers back to the synagogue in its heyday. In the book, it was different. He returns to a graveyard, the famous cemetery of Ferrara. But we changed it to the temple, which bookends the piece. And what happens is that the ruined temple becomes an active temple back in his youth. And he sees himself as barely a little bit older than a bar mitzvah boy. And the young heir to the Finzi-Contini family, Nicole Finzi-Contini, sitting with her father in the men's section, which is already showing her entitlement.
Right.
And
disrespect for the rules.
Disrespect. They can do what they want. And his father, who's a populist and a Mussolini supporter, dislikes the Finzi-Contini family because they are entitled and elitist and apolitical. And he warns his son, the Finzi-Continis are different. They're practically not Jewish. Stay away from them and don't fall in love with this girl. And that's the first aria we hear in the synagogue while they're supposed to be playing. The father is basically lecturing the son.
And the people in the congregation are there too.
They're davening. They're, you know, it's an Orthodox, yeah. So they kind of daven right. at their own pace. And they're swaying and davening. And the women are in the women's section. I don't know exactly how much we're going to see, but in my mind, Nicole's brother, Alberto, who's gay but doesn't know it yet, is sitting with his mother in the women's section. It's, you know, your typical dysfunctional Jewish family.
Behind a garden wall, out for a prayer at the synagogue. Okay,
right.
This is the Finzi-Continis are different.
Life is short.
Listening to Cat Radio Cafe, I'm Janet Coleman here with Ricky Ian Gordon, the composer, and the librettist lyricist Michael Corey, discussing their upcoming world premiere of the opera The Garden of the Finzi Contini's. You just heard an aria. The Jews are holiday Jews. These are holiday Jews. They only come out to the temple to show off on the holidays, really, or to
the high holidays
make a bow to their connection to the temple, which they built, right? They built this temple.
They built it.
It wasn't so different when I was
growing up either in Teaneck, New Jersey.
Yeah.
You know, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, that was when midi skirts and maxi skirts were coming out. And it was a fashion show to come to this temple. And then you wouldn't see anyone the rest of the year.
I remember schlepping out to Newark, New Jersey, to visit my grandmother, who was in the temple only in the holy holidays. We couldn't we didn't even have a seat, but we looked in there and watched Grandma pray, and that was good enough.
Yes,
and kept go back and go home to being a socialist. That's the way it goes. Not so different. I mean, here I was a little surprised to find the father being pro Mussolini, because I hadn't figured that into my reading of the pre-war Italians, that they were so in love with Mussolini themselves and expecting something good there.
I hate to say it, but it's like the way so many Jews love Trump.
Yeah, I guess so. Anyway, Sheldon Adelson and others, I guess.
Yeah,
I guess they're
because they think he's good for Israel, even if he is a cancer for this country.
Right. Well, he made a wonderful case for it, didn't he? I don't know how they believed him. I mean, anyway, they wanted to. They knew they weren't Democrats, put it that way.
Right.
Anyway, What's interesting to me is how much scholarship really goes into actually all the titles of your pieces, mutual or otherwise, entail enormous amount of scholarship research. But here you not only you have Italian language to deal with, you have English, and there's a little bit of Yiddish in there, and you're being produced by, well, the New York City Opera, but also the Yiddish Theater Volksbühne. And were there a lot of, I'm curious to know whether they had a lot to put into this, or whether they said anything about it, or they wanted it this way or that, whether you made the grade as, Jews. composition of this piece.
We're very lucky in that respect, because mm-hmm. the Volksbühne is very attuned to all the accuracies yeah. of the Judaism and the Yiddish yeah. and all that,
yeah.
and is actually encouraging us to put less Yiddish, because the Italian Jews were different. They didn't use Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't Middle European. And Michael mm-hmm. Capasso, who runs the City Opera, is Italian-American. And he's giving us all the details on the Italian verisimilitude. So we've got it from both ends, and I think we're going to be super accurate.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And how is your Italian? I mean, did that affect the writing of the lyrics?
Ricky, do you speak Italian?
Well, yeah, I studied for 3 years, and when Michael was writing it, Janet, I had him go to my teacher, a man named Bob Coward, who is the language coach at the Metropolitan Opera. And Bob would go over the Italian with Michael. Luckily, I knew how to set it to music. But we were always checking on it. But there's always more to learn, as we've been working on it. As Michael said, Michael Capasso will have opinions. Lucy Yates, our translator, will have opinions. So we're obviously open to
right. We also had a
more
we also had a scholar in Italy read the whole thing. And make sure that we were historically accurate. That comes from my journalistic background. I just, mm-hmm. everything has to be correct.
Yes.
Then we can bend the fictional aspects of it as we see fit, take artistic license, but it has to be based on a bedrock of correct facts.
Yes. Yes.
Well, it's interesting that this is your, Michael, anyway, this is your second musical effort on behalf of a ruined estate. Grey Gardens, did you ever notice? I guess some Marx was right that property is theft, because if you don't put a lot into it, it goes away after
oh,
you steal
Grey Gardens
it. After you steal
ruined.
It.
Grey Gardens is ruined from the beginning. Finzi Catini's is not ruined until
true.
They're taken away.
It's ruined by right. It's ruined by human effort. Gardens, not by political.
What we did in Grey Gardens that hadn't been done before in the documentary was to imagine it in its heyday and write a whole act
yeah.
about that
right.
and plant
yeah.
the seeds of ruin that
right.
were going to materialize in Act Two.
Right.
And in essence, we're doing that. You know what it is in an opera? You have to. The film of the Finzi Catini's De Sica was so brilliant, and that mm. gorgeous shot of the tennis court,
yes,
which
yes.
had grown overgrown and full
yeah.
of weeds and mm-hmm. windswept and rainswept and ruined, no longer gorgeous like it was when the young people were playing on it. You can do that with one gesture in the film, but you can't do that on the stage. You have to write something. You have to find a way of conveying that through music and words and acting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I did read the libretto, and the libretto is attached to it seem to me sketches for the eventual scenery that is going to be part of the opera, the performance. Is that correct?
That's not an afterthought. That's a part of the yeah. process that I go
yeah.
through. And Ricky and I both enjoy looking at sort of. Well, what do you call it when you do that for a movie, when you sort of sketch it out?
Storyboard.
Storyboarding.
And Michael storyboards his operas.
We storyboard them so that we can see visually what should be in
right.
the scene and have a feeling for it. And then Ricky suggests, well, include it in the script so that other people can see it if it's helpful to them. But it's purely using Photoshop, taking a lot of images, merging them together. And while I do that, I actually write in my head. I say, oh,
no
yeah,
one
need,
does
that.
That. No one else does that.
I need that. I need that. Well, actually, the great composer John Corigliano watercolors on his scores.
Is that true?
I think it does. If you look at his orchestral scores, he's watercolored on them. A big swath of color, and it influences him. It's how he feels. It's a tangible process. And
what does a set designer? What does a set designer do when he sees your sketches? Does he say, "I can't be this good"?
Well, one set designer, Alan Moyer, who did The Grapes of Wrath, he has his own vision. But he did ask me, which scenes are the most important to you? And I said, well, spend your money here. in the same instance here, our set designer actually visited Ferrara, Italy, took his own historical photographs, and is envisioning it in his own way, which I think is going to be quite beautiful and simple and elegant.
How typical was Ferrara among Italian small cities in terms of being wowed by Mussolini and then being, you know, trapped in a sense? And we'll talk a little bit about what the Finzi Contini's were trapped in, just the enormous amount of landscape that existed for them. How unique was this town,
Ricky,
or was it just
Pisani's?
You visited Pisani's?
Ferrara. Tell us about that.
Ferrara is definitely belongs more to the north than to the south. So it's more aristocratic. It's also it's flat, by the way, which is why that all those bicycles in the movie and in the story. But I would say that politically Ferrara probably leaned more to the left than the south at the time. But in many ways they were just as fickle, you know, I mean, until they couldn't be anymore. I mean, but it's just human nature, I think. You just want your life to continue as it's continuing until it looks like until it's impossible to catch it.
Well, it is impossible.
Italy was different depending on which region you were with your politics and how it affected World War II and the Holocaust. As it happened, Ferrara was on a direct train line to Auschwitz.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. So they could be easily processed.
Easily
that way.
Transported, yes.
Transported, get rid of them. Yeah.
But, you know, it's important to say, Jen, while we're talking about this opera, that there really is, meanwhile, the juxtaposition of young people who are still dead set on enjoying their lives and loving who they love and sleeping with who they sleep with and yearning for what they yearn for. And that is what the opera's about. It is the backdrop that is devastating, but it's what makes human life so poignant in the first place is the way we go on living our lives, loving who we love, obsessing on what we obsess on, no matter what's happening in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's only us looking at these people in a fishbowl that know whether they love each other or not, whether Nicole decides to love Georgia or not. It doesn't matter. They're all going to die.
Right. Although some sooner than others.
Yes.
Yeah.
And more malignantly than the others.
But they don't know.
Right.
There's
a beautiful quartet that Ricky wrote in the first act called Lotomy, which is about the souvenir glass that Nicole has a habit of collecting when she goes to flea markets and glass fairs. And
when she travels, she's a big
she travels
aficionado,
around and finds this Latomy, which is not valuable glass, but she just likes it. And she sings about this glass, sort of impervious or oblivious to Giorgio's feelings, which are fragile as glass, as she's sort of railroading over him. Mm-hmm. And then the other two, her brother Alberto, who's in love with his college roommate, Malnati. Malnati singing about politics and communism is better, and the brother is saying, when is he going to notice that I have feelings for him? They're all fragile as Lotomy, and it's all going to be crushed in Act Two, and they don't see it, but they're so in love.
They're tragically oblivious.
They're magically
and maybe
oblivious.
Not tragically, because what else should you be? I mean, if they weren't oblivious, what would they be doing, hiding under the carpet? I mean, right. You still have to live your life. Right. We're living our lives here. Who knows what's going to happen? Right. It may be that democracy is done in 2024.
I know. I think that this is bad. This 2021 and 22 are not my favorite years, but they may be the best years of what's coming.
It could be, and for some it already is. It's already come. Let's face it.
Right.
It's already come. It's come to the women of Texas.
Right.
It's come to.
Right.
It's going to happen to the women in Mississippi. I mean, it's
all
going on all
voting.
The time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is the decline of the West for sure. I was thinking how those Latini are so similar to the glass menagerie, really,
yes.
In terms of
the symbolism.
Yeah, the symbolism of the fragile glass. And the fragile characters that
and you do wonder if Bassani read Tennessee Williams,
yeah,
because it's such a direct influence.
Yeah, yeah. They were around the same time, and
yes,
my feeling is always if there's a good idea, use it.
Right, right.
Let's all have fragile glass
right.
in our plays.
Let's all have fragile glass.
By the way, this is WBAI. You're listening to here at 99.5 on the FM dial. And I'm Janet Coleman, here with Ricky Ian Gordon and Michael Khoury, respectively the composer and librettist lyricist of an opera about to appear at the New Jewish Memorial?
Volksbühne.
The
New Jewish Heritage Museum?
The museum. And I mean, a perfect, really perfect kind of place, which has some of the aura of the temple, really, about
it. Well, it's a Holocaust memorial.
So
and it's opening on Holocaust Remembrance Day.
Right. Important to the sacredness, really, of the event. And anyway, the opera is called The Garden of the Finzi Continis. It's based on Giorgio Bassini's 1962 novel. And the creators of the opera have both seen Vittorio De Sica's movie on the same story. And, you know, I was bringing up the visual component of the garden because it was so strong in the film and so strong in your sketches of the garden. This is a garden that encloses them with beauty and also traps them with inability, really, to grow stuff anymore. Talk about the metaphor of the garden of the Finzi Fontinis, which are so sumptuous and beautiful and blooming and full of old, old trees.
Well, I think that once the land extended for a great deal more, but it got bought up. They rented it out to farmers. They sold it off. Now it's more contained. And what the garden mostly consists of is trees, at least to Nicole. Did that come from the novel, Ricky?
Yes. I think, not to press the obvious button, but it represents fecundity. It's, it's the fecundity before the barrenness, It's this summer before the winter.
But I think that Giorgio takes a walk with her, and she's showing him all the wonderful trees and plantings, and he's expecting to see, an English garden or a French garden, flowers, and he sees trees. Mm-hmm. And she's insulted that he doesn't respond to the trees as she does, because she thinks of herself as a tree, that she's got roots that go deep into the earth and branches that reach for the sky. But basically, you can't move a tree, and she's not moving, and the trees aren't moving. And she has a feeling that she's like the trees and will never leave the garden.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's also like old money and old, that they have been there forever. It's a long family line.
Right. These old trees have been here for centuries, right?
Right. And I'll talk a little bit about the communist boyfriend of Alberto and how he is college friend, but he's an original presence too, and yet he's a communist. He's a real left winger, unlike Giorgio's father. He has a whole different view of life, and yet Talk about his character and
he's a communist who enjoys hanging out with rich people and playing on their tennis courts and driving around in their fancy cars and having rich friends.
He's a high holiday socialist.
He's a high holiday communist.
Yes.
He believes, you know, the book identified him as a chemist working in the rubber plant, which was interesting. The film wasn't so specific. But I think that philosophically and intellectually, his sympathies lay with communism, but he would rather enjoy the bourgeois pleasures that he does.
Right.
It's almost like a choice for him. It's almost like a masculine choice. Like he chooses a set of beliefs that go along with who he thinks he is sexually. It's like macho beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? But I don't think he really stands for them.
I think we've amplified the relationship between him and and Alberto, the gay brother. It was in the book. It was alluded to in the film. Bassani wrote some short stories, which we were influenced by. But we also just thought about what it was like for them to be college roommates. There's a song that Ricky wrote called The College Days, where we took a little bit of dramatic license and Malnati describes driving around in cars, making love with girls, and Alberto was watching him in the rear view mirror of the car, doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, a virgin.
That's what we get to do. That's what we get to do as writers. That's what we, in Grapes of Wrath, we could expand on the part of Noah, because it was a personal opinion we had that we felt like Steinbeck just gets rid of Noah, and we felt like it was unfair. So we gave Noah a proper death. Well, Alberto wasn't gay enough in the book, so we made him gayer.
Gayer. And sicker.
Gayer.
And sicker.
Yes.
Well,
and more of a character. He had more motivation.
Right. He is sick in the book, and he dies before anyone else. And as Ricky has pointed out, he's the only one that is buried in the cemetery of Ferrara, because everyone else was sent to the camps.
The huge family crypt that's almost garish when it's built. But time has darkened it, but the only person buried there is Alberto.
Wow.
No one knows where any of the other Vincentinis
are. It took a little bit of research, but though it wasn't mentioned specifically in the novel, Jews were not allowed to leave the country or the province for medical reasons. And he was sick. He needed to be treated by a specialist, and he was not allowed to go. So he was forced, imprisoned in his beautiful prison, to die. And he knew he was dying of a blood disorder.
It's amazing how many laws they created. It's something like the abortion laws. You can't avoid them. You can't get out of them. They're like a cage.
It's scary.
The anti-Semitic laws, the anti-Jewish laws that were passed. I mean, that you could not have servants, you couldn't cash checks, you couldn't put money in the bank. Talk a little bit about those deprivations that are part of the boiling water, and how you researched them, and how easily you found out about them, and how and what problems there were in kind of getting a grip on them.
The book mentioned that new laws have been passed, but I was just, as a journalist, I just said, what were those laws? I want to read them. And we found the Manifesto della Razza, which was not in either the book or the movie, and we musicalized it. We showed, rather than somebody saying, oh, they're taking away our rights, we actually showed people trying to go about their everyday life. The father goes to the bank, the son goes to the library, the other son goes to play tennis, and they find out they've been barred, banned. They're no longer allowed to do their daily activities. The mother cannot even employ her cook or cleaning lady like she had before, because Jews cannot employ non-Jews. Non-Jews are not allowed to win the tennis match, so therefore they can't play in a public court.
Right.
And little by little, they put all these laws on the books. It lays the groundwork for deporting them. And that's what's happening here. These things are getting on the book. It's impossible to turn back. You know, these states are changing their state constitutions and voting laws. They're making, tying these laws up if they get challenged in court forever. And then what do we do? we're going to need a second civil war to get this undone.
Well, let's listen to a little music now, to avoid some of the unsavory visions we are having now. But this is the epilogue. This is some music from the epilogue. And do you want to set that up a little, or listen to it first and then tell us what goes on? Let's listen to the music, I think.
Yeah, let's listen first.
Yeah, okay. Well, we have here about 2.5 minutes to hear what the conclusion of this play is meant to suggest to us as the audience now living through this experience of the Finzi-Continis and the people of Ferrara.
And Janet, you should know that is the finale to Act One. That's not the epilogue.
Right.
That you played.
Oh, so, I'm sorry. Big mistake.
That's fine, but what is he singing to the eternal flame in the ruined synagogue? But you cut off just before we realize he has two conflicts. He's basically asking God to save Italy and to make Nicole love him. Uh-huh. And it's sort of the heartbreaking finale to Act One, where we see this individual, this you know, just past being a boy, in the heat of such desire, and seeing his country ruined and his heart broken at the same time, and he doesn't know where to go with it, right, Michael?
Well, also, his younger brother is saying, we should get out now while we can. He's saying, absolutely not. This is not going to happen to Italy. It can't.
Right.
And Nicole is going to love me. So we see him willfully adapting self-delusion.
Right.
And it's interesting that the pressure of the father, who was the pro-Mussolini father, is the person who finally sees the light and buys the tickets for his two sons, realizing he's not going to make it, the mother's not going to, whole family is going to be shipped off to Germany, and the two boys will carry the seed, I suppose, of the family
right.
and live on. although, and live with the memory of what has occurred in
One of the interpreters of Bassani sort of talked about the tyranny of memory. Mm-hmm. That memory is not a sentimental, lovely thing. Memory is painful. And that's how the opera begins. He has gotten out from Italy in time. He probably has emigrated to America. Now he's come back for the war to see what happened. And the memory of everything that did does not resolve anything.
Right. It is
right.
Double pain. Well, that's reality. I mean, that's why I think this thing is so moving and deserves so much to be seen and listened to. It's really a brilliant work. And I wish I had more time I know you'll expound on this a lot, to talk about the nature of your collaboration, but I can hear from the way you overlap each other that it's there's a real dualism there in creating this work. And I want to thank you so much for joining us here tonight and giving us so much, really, explanation of what goes into the making of an opera, even in our own language.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure. I was so caught up at the notion of making this into a music-filled work of art, and so it is. You've taken it to the garden of the Finzi Cantini to another level, and now other music. Yeah, you've been listening to Cat Radio Cafe, now heard weekly at 9 p.m. Tuesdays on WBAI. I'm Janet Coleman, and you are?
David Dozer.
Yeah, the displaced playwright. You can reach us at catradiocafe@gmail.com, and you can pledge to the WBAI Tower Fund at 212-209-2950.
Or you can go online to towerfund.wbai.org. And add a contribution in any amount to keep the WBAI signal alive.
With special thanks to John L. Mella, on tonight's show we were joined by composer Ricky Ian Gordon and librettist, lyricist Michael Khoury to discuss the upcoming world premiere of their opera, The Garden of the Finzi Cantinis, about an old and aristocratic Italian-Jewish family on the eve of World War II who believe themselves immune to the encroaching Jewish racial laws and the coming alliance between Mussolini's fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. The show opens on January 27th on International Holocaust Memorial Day and runs through February 8th at Edmund J. Safra Hall at the Museum of Jewish Heritage, a living memorial to the Holocaust. See you next week.
Bye.
Through the windows of cars, ooh, 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 ooh.
Hey, this is Baby K.
And this is DJ Kyle McNeil
of The Sweet Spot. And we are so excited to announce our brand new time slot, Tuesday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight.
Same great soulful sounds, old and new.
Brand new day, Tuesdays at 10 p.m.
Only on WBAI 99.5 FM.
New York's Pacifica Radio.
Sweet Tuesday, darling Tuesday, baby, take us.
This is DJ Black Icon 1.
This is Mama Soul.
And I am The Law. And every week on our show, The Harlem Connection, we give you the connection to things that make Harlem a cultural mecca. And this week, we're focusing on the nightclubs of Harlem, the places that play jazz, hip-hop, Afro-pop, and other genres. We'll give you that exposure.
And you can catch The Harlem Connection this Friday evening, 10 p.m., and the rebroadcast, 3 a.m. Sunday morning.
And if you happen to miss us Friday night, definitely check us out via WBAI.org/archive.
Greetings, this is Dr. James. McIntosh, host of Mindfield, which comes to you every Wednesday at 2 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. Together with my co-host, nurse family therapist, Richardina Theodore, we delve into the explosive issues in mental health. Our mission is to help you know yourself, release your anxieties and your depression, and free your mind. Only on WBAI, the voice of the voiceless, can we voiceless ones be heard. Support the show and WBAI by donating at give2wbai.org. That's the word give, the number 2, at wbai.org. Or by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You can support the show and the station even more by going to give2wbai.org and giving a monthly donation of as little as $10 per month as a WBAI buddy to your favorite show on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Yo, check this out. This is Chuck, your public enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights, 99.5 WBAI.
Massive and expensive equipment marks the professional radio station. But in the amateur field, radio parts often include pieces of assorted junk, ingeniously assembled by operators, and lots of strange radio parts, such as whiskey glasses mounted on a cake tin. Ma's funnel actually becomes a loudspeaker, and her sieve, part of a microphone. Winding a coil becomes comparatively simple when using the family egg beater. All amateurs are heroes of the air at heart and dream of a chance to serve humanity whenever a calamity occurs. And speaking of calamities, well...
Hey there, all our beloved radio listeners. Yes, we're in a bit of a calamity right now with an urgent need here at WBAI to pay our radio tower back rent or cease to broadcast. And here at this radio station, we'd like to continue to serve humanity, but without having to resort to those egg beaters and cake tins in an emergency. So please donate whatever you can by calling in to 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or visiting the Donate to Our Tower Fund at the top of the BAI website page. And Arts Express thanks you.
Remember, the whole reason New York City housing, NYCHA housing, was built the way it was Corbusier understood that if you did not have light coming in every window and if every room did not have air and light, people could not thrive. That was the whole reason for getting rid of the tenements that go with it.
Maureen Coates, environmental lawyer with Planet A Strategies. Hi, I'm Michael G. Haskins, host of Living for the City on WBAI 99.5 FM, Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Every week, myself and senior producer Jillian Jonas take an in-depth look at the city of New York as it is developing right before our very eyes. We bring on grassroots organizations fighting to have their voices heard in how the community in which they live will grow and prosper into the future. So tune in to Living for the City Wednesdays at 11 a.m. over listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.